Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Mothball Prophecies. Accept no cheap imitations. I am your host, Jonathan. Today, we are picking up where we last left off with the mysterious death of Dr. Mary Sherman, as we unravel the threads to a global conspiracy. For those of you who are just joining us, I advise you to go back and listen to the first episode. But if you want to persevere, here are some brief notes. In July of 1964, the charred body of Dr. Mary Sherman was found in her apartment with the right arm disintegrated. No signs of a struggle were found, but many post-mortem wounds were discovered. In 1967, Jim Garrison, district attorney in New Orleans, gave a lengthy interview with Playboy linking the murder of Dr. Sherman to David Ferry's preoccupation with cancer experiments, theorizing that Jack Ruby was in fact injected with live cancer cells prior to his death. Since the 1960s, there has been a rise in pandemics, viral outbreaks, and an increase in various forms of cancer throughout the world. And this is where we pick up our story. Now, one of the major questions for those playing at home is, where the hell did all of this occur? Well, and I didn't know this until I started researching this topic, almost every place mentioned is within walking distance of my house. The location of the underground lab? I used to stroll by there every morning when I would take my walk down to Louisiana Avenue Parkway. Dr. Mary Sherman's apartment? That turned out to be on the 3100 block of St. Charles Avenue. Heck, Lee Harvey Oswald had an apartment on Magazine Street not too far from me. And while lots of the macabre tourism in New Orleans attracts people who want to know about ghosts and swamp monsters, there are those who want to take in the sights of more fact-based locations, and David Ferry's and Lee Harvey Oswald's abodes are no exception. JFK enthusiasts flock to those locations, in much the same way that punks come to New Orleans to see the last place Johnny Thunders was seen alive. But among all of the locations, the one I received the most messages about over the past 2 weeks was where the heck a particle accelerator was hidden in New Orleans. Particle accelerators, especially those from the 1960s, were very large and loud devices. For the sake of brevity, and because I'm not a scientist in real life, the particle accelerators of the 50s and 60s blasted a given target with subatomic particles. This opened up a new realm for scientific, medical, and commercial applications. In the gem industry, for instance, particle accelerators can be used to take out impurities in diamonds. There's even a story of one Jack Nygaard, who was an engineer in Boston, and he figured out how to use a linear accelerator for cross-bonding wood, making it super strong. Jack apparently left Boston and set up shop in Seattle, where he made a killing manufacturing super strong wood for bowling alleys. That is, until one fateful day when his assistant accidentally flipped the switch while Jack Nygaard was directly in the path of the accelerator's beam. The story goes that they swept up his ashes after the accident. In all my research, I could not find a single report or archived article on the tragedy of Jack Nygaard, and I think it was originally told as a cautionary tale. That, or Ed Haslam, the author of Dr. Mary's Monkey, was making up stories out of whole cloth. But we know no conspiracy theorist would deign to do that, right? However, I want you to keep the death of Jack Nygaard in mind for later on in the episode. Needless to say, if there was a linear particle accelerator in New Orleans, it would have been difficult to hide. However, if we are to believe the author, and you are to believe your host, the U.S. government placed pressure on hospitals and universities throughout the U.S. in the 1950s and 60s to produce viable vaccines for the general population and to carry out other health-related experiments. blasting living tissue with a beam would destroy the target cells, so some particle accelerators were designed to shoot at a platinum pyramid at the far end of the room, which would diffuse the beam. Oxford University had one such accelerator. The lab where the accelerator was housed was a building on the grounds of the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, located at 210 State Street, which is not quite in my walking radius. Formerly the Marine Hospital, the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital operated until 1981. After that, it was purchased by the Children's Hospital. According to Ed Haslam, one of his connections was able to get into the structures there. The contact was an engineer, and the remains inside one of the buildings contained metal walls, extremely heavy wiring for high-voltage equipment, small rooms that were completely lined with 1-inch thick asbestos sheets, but missing were the accelerator itself and the platinum pyramid. But the interior of the building was certainly laid out to house such things. To be more specific, to those of you who want to go spelunking. And because the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital was on a sizable campus, the linear particle accelerator was allegedly housed in the infectious disease laboratory. And Dr. Ochsner did receive payments from the U.S. government to carry out experiments, while armed guards moved equipment and shipments in and out of the back gate of the hospital. Suddenly, the notion that David Ferry was interested in cancer and kept hundreds of little mice seems like it was something more than just a hobby. For the record, David Ferry didn't live in his lab. He lived a few blocks from his lab, as did Dr. Mary Sherman. Under the direct approval of Dr. Ochsner, Mary Sherman would help to mutate monkey cells in the lab with the particle accelerator for vaccines as well as other things. The results would then be taken to the little lab off Louisiana Avenue Parkway, which was rented by David Ferry, where he, Oswald, and another person would inject the mutated tissue into mice and observe the results. "Hold on, Jonathan," I hear you exclaim. "If David Ferry hated communists so much, why in the name of everything that's red, white, and blue would he be working side by side with Lee Harvey Oswald? Wasn't Ferry working with Cuban exiles to overthrow Castro? Wasn't Oswald working to overthrow our government? I mean, this is a fantastic setup for a sitcom. Think about it. David Ferry and Lee Harvey Oswald going all over town trying to capture mice and rats in New Orleans, arguing their diametrically opposed ideologies, and Dr. Alton Ochsner is their landlord? I'd watch that." But this also raises another question. Since Dr. Ochsner was known for his ultra-conservative political views, why the heck was Oswald on his payroll as well? To answer these questions, we have to go to a coffee company, specifically the Riley Coffee Company, located at 640 Magazine Street, New Orleans, Louisiana, on the corner of Girard in the beautiful French Quarter. The Riley Coffee Company no longer exists. It's now an apartment building, but back in the late spring of 1963, the Riley Coffee Company employed two people of interest to our story, Lee Harvey Oswald and Judith Vary Baker. Now, a lot of people may have heard of Lee Harvey Oswald. He did some stuff, apparently. But not many people know Judith Vary Baker. At least, I'd never heard of her. Yet her very existence, at least in her words alone, is a veritable rabbit's hole for the conspiracy-minded. Judith Vary Baker grew up in Bradenton, Florida. There is evidence of this from newspaper clippings where a young Judith Vary Baker was shown in her cancer lab with her mice during her high school years. She was able to create lung cancer in her mice faster than anyone known in medical science, and her drive was to find a cure for cancer. This opened up many opportunities for Judith, replete with tuition, invitations, and more. Soon she found herself in a cancer research training program at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York. Don't get your hopes up. This story doesn't have aliens. I'm saving that for two episodes from now. It was at the Roswell Park Cancer Institute that Judith studied under experts like Dr. Edwin Mirand, who co-authored a paper, Human Susceptibility to a Simian Tumor Virus. So Judith Vary Baker would have been aware of how viruses from monkeys could be transmitted to people or used as a carrier for cancer or other mutations. According to Judith Vary Baker herself, and by proxy Ed Haslam, Dr. Alton Ochsner extended an invitation for her to come work in New Orleans in 1963. She accepted with the provision that she'd receive early admission to Tulane Medical School. During the first month, Judith ran into a man at the post office named Lee Harvey Oswald. Looking back, however, Judith Vary Baker has stated that this was not a chance encounter. And this is where we step on the gas in our little story, while simultaneously letting go of the steering wheel. According to Ed Haslam and Judith Vary Baker, who was not quite interviewed on 60 Minutes for her tell-all tale, and not quite featured on the History Channel's The Men Who Killed Kennedy, but who did publish the book Lee and Me, soon to be a musical, I kid you not. Anyway, according to Ed and Judith, Oswald and David Ferry were already working together. Oswald and Judith, both married at the time, were falling in love, and Lee actually took Judith to meet Guy Bannister, where they discussed the, quote, Get Castro project, though Judith had no idea what that was at the time. Oswald was an information runner, and he escorted Judith all over town, to dinner at Dr. Mary Sherman's apartment with David Ferry, and more. And if you read the book Lee and Me by Judith Vary Baker, she provides all sorts of documentation to verify her existence in New Orleans in 1963 and her relationship with Lee Harvey Oswald. She even shows pay stubs from the Riley Coffee Company, which is where I was going before I got off on this tangent. See, the plan to develop cancer in a lab and inject it into Castro to take down the threat of communism off the shores of the U.S. would have been seen as a big deal and needed to be handled delicately. So Judith and Oswald were given cover jobs working at the coffee company. While working there, Judith and Lee could slip out in the afternoons to work in an underground lab in a small apartment filled with mice. I now want to give you a tiny, minuscule sample of what Judith Vary Baker witnessed, according to her own words and Ed Haslam. Jack Ruby visited David Ferry's apartment one day when Judith and Lee Harvey Oswald were there. Ferry introduced him to Judith as Sparky Rubenstein. Judith was surprised that Ferry briefed Ruby on their bioweapon project. Why not? They all worked for Carlos Marcello, after all. Ruby recognized Lee and said that he used to see him at parties when he was a boy. This meant that Jack Ruby knew about Oswald's connection to the underground medical laboratory when he shot him, and he knew about the cancer cocktails that could be used to silence him as he awaited trial for Oswald's murder. Yes, I know how crazy this sounds, and we're nowhere close to finishing. During Judith's time in New Orleans, she hung around with Oswald, Dr. Mary Sherman, David Ferry, Guy Bannister, mob boss Carlos Marcello, and pretty much every single freaking character involved in the JFK assassination. And yes, she did overhear a plot to kill JFK, but that was nothing compared to what we're talking about right now, is it? But it does raise an interesting question about Lee Harvey Oswald. If Lee Harvey Oswald was, by all accounts, a communist, how do we resolve his relationships with patriotic conservatives like Dr. Ochsner, David Ferry, Guy Bannister, and the rest? Well, thankfully, Ed Haslam and Judith Vary Baker are more than happy to provide a solution for that equation. I want you to think of an answer. Your wildest answer as to why Oswald led a double life. You got one? I guarantee that whatever you came up with was 1, much more complex, and 2, much more logical than what Ed and Judith laid down in their books. Their answer was this. Those photographs and short films of Oswald handing out pro-communist flyers in New Orleans, those were staged. In fact, Dr. Ochsner arranged for them to be taken to throw people off the scent of this whole project. If anyone knew Lee Harvey Oswald was a communist, it would be much easier to get him into Cuba. At the same time, no one would suspect that Oswald was there to deliver an injection of patriotic, freedom-loving red, white, and blue cancer directly into Castro, toppling communism, thus liberating cigars and classic cars in the Western Hemisphere. Going one step further, Oswald leaving New Orleans to go to Dallas in 1963 may have been to take care of loose ends, along with his own demise at the hands of Jack Ruby, and along with Ruby's own untimely death, because the public just wouldn't have been ready to know that our government was engineering biological weapons to take down world leaders. But why would he do that instead of going directly to Cuba? We're going to gloss over that, because all information I found also glosses over that. I mean, can you imagine what that would mean to the world? It would upset international relations. The world would become very hostile to America, and over what? A virus? To bring it to the local stage, can you imagine how such a project, if exposed, would impact tourism here in New Orleans? But I digress. I'm not here to talk about the JFK assassination. Go find the hundreds of other podcasts and books and documentaries and subreddits and whatever else you want to learn about grounded and well-researched facts. But if you want to stay on this tragical history tour, stick with me, because now we're getting on to the screaming monkeys. Back at the big lab, that's the one with the particle accelerator, many monkeys were killed, according to Judith Vary Baker. She can't say how many monkeys, but Dr. Ochsner and Dr. Mary Sherman ordered, quote, thousands of pounds of monkeys. And people wonder why Montgomery Ward went out of business. To go back to the first episode, the simian immunodeficiency virus, or simply SV40, was what contaminated part of the first batch of polio vaccines. Technology was leveraged to filter out SV40 from the vaccines in the 1960s. Technology, such as a particle accelerator. Similarly, that technology could have been used to mutate SV40 into something far more sinister, such as cancer, or a completely new virus. So now we have our full cast of players. Dr. Ochsner, who headed up the project to develop new types of weaponized cancer for the U.S. government. Dr. Mary Sherman, who was ultimately in charge of both the big lab with the particle accelerator, as well as the little lab near David Ferry's apartment, filled with all those little mice. Lee Harvey Oswald, an information runner who was building a believable cover as a pinko anti-American so he could eventually get to Cuba and inject Castro with cancer. David Ferry, who helped run the little lab on Louisiana Avenue Parkway and who hated Castro and all things to the left of Father Coughlin. Judith Vary Baker, who was a technician, by her own admission, at the little lab. So what happened? How did we get from this all-star lineup to the mysterious death of Dr. Mary Sherman? I'll attempt to fill in the blanks about the science project gone awry after these messages from a modern-day mad scientist.
secretum of the Consortium of Genius here, ensconced within my secret lab. At long last, the time has come to reveal my master plan. While you have all been preoccupied with that insipid but popular virus making the rounds, I have been readying my laboratory for a bold new test. The evaluation and elimination of my sonic competition for World Takeover! Yes, ladies and gentlemen, every week I shall be capturing a different band here in the secret lab and subjecting them to hideous, hard-rocking experimentation live! Friday night at 8 p.m. Be here to see what fate befalls the unwary and find out if they can escape from the secret lab!
That's Escape from the Secret Lab every Friday night at 8 p.m. Central. Tune in to watch great bands perform, and you, yes you, can help determine the outcome and win great prizes. Go to escapefromthesecretlab.com today. Now, back to the conspiracy theory. The main theory, which falls well outside of what was reported in the papers, but lines up with the coroner's report that I read in episode 1, is as follows. Late at night, Dr. Mary Sherman was working in the big lab with the particle accelerator, mutating monkey genes to either cure cancer or to develop a biological weapon. She reached with her right arm to flip a switch, and something went horribly wrong, causing electricity to run from the panel and down the right side of her body. The 500,000-volt charge disintegrated Dr. Mary Sherman's arm and scorched the right side of her body. But Mary wasn't dead. Suffering and horribly burned and disfigured, yes, but not dead. The theory advanced by Ed Haslam is that someone, probably Dr. Ochsner, or possibly David Ferry, or both with the help of Oswald, wrapped up Dr. Sherman, put her in her own car, and drove to her apartment. They parked the car a few blocks away, which would line up with the reports from the crime scene. Then they hauled Dr. Sherman up to her apartment and, using her keys, quietly entered and laid the body on the floor. Out of mercy, someone with medical skill made incisions to let the air out of her lungs, and then made haphazard cuts on her body post-mortem to make it look like an attack. Because the charred body of Dr. Mary Sherman would seem out of place in the middle of a perfect apartment, the accomplices covered her with clothes, many of which were neatly folded when the police arrived, and set them on fire. However, the temperature was not hot enough to cause the burns Dr. Mary Sherman received, nor the disintegration of her arm. Heck, many of the clothes weren't even ablaze, as they needed to achieve temperatures higher than 500 degrees to catch fire. Moreover, if you remember, nothing was stolen from Dr. Mary Sherman's apartment. Her purse was empty, but that would have been to remove any form of identification. The jewelry box that was in plain sight and other valuables, those had been left untouched. The police were running into dead ends, and after reaching out to the FBI, the memo from Hoover came down that the feds would not be extending resources to help with the case. The theory goes that the lack of assistance from the FBI was not because it was a waste of their resources, but because it would have exposed the secret project that Dr. Mary and Alton Ochsner were working on, and its direct ties to the U.S. government. Considering Dr. Mary Sherman's death occurred in the summer of 1964, this also would have thrown a huge wrench into the proceedings of the Warren Commission, which were being finalized at that time. A conspiracy sanctioned by the United States to kill Castro with a biological weapon involving Dr. Ochsner, Lee Harvey Oswald, David Ferry, and others? This would have forced open new investigations and shed light on a potentially darker side of America than the ham-handed conclusions drawn around the assassination of JFK the previous year. But was this murder? Was the big lab sabotage to kill Dr. Mary Sherman, to silence her, to deliver some sort of retribution? Or to tie up loose ends following Lee Harvey Oswald's murder? We'll never know. But the story doesn't end there. I've been showing you the very localized machinations surrounding the death of Dr. Mary Sherman, branching out into wider circles as we went. Now it's time to look at the global implications of what took place in New Orleans during 1963 and 1964, and how they may have impacted our lives to this very day. See, Dr. Sherman's death may not have caused the entire project to shut down. David Ferry, holding dear the American qualities of patriotism, anti-communism, and racism, may have decided to continue the project, but in a very different direction. To give listeners a touchstone, we're going back to the early 1980s, when a particular health crisis was taking the world by storm, creating a whole new generation of paranoid germaphobes. I'm talking about AIDS. That's right. If you thought the story so far was just about the murder of a beloved doctor here in New Orleans, or just about a plot to kill Castro, or just about tangential ties to the JFK assassination, buckle up, Buttercup. Things are about to get dark and crazy. AIDS may have come to the forefront in the 1980s, but it is believed that the first case emerged in the 1970s. If you ask most Americans where AIDS originated, most of them would probably say Africa. This is in part due to the high concentration of AIDS and HIV in Africa, but chronologically, it did not start there. It would be like anyone else in the world saying that COVID-19 originated in America because of how awesome a job we've done containing that pandemic. Back in 1983, it was theorized that AIDS was caused by a mutation of the H1N1 virus that was intentionally exposed to the Cuban pig population as an act of political sabotage. That's right, they thought swine flu was a big political move. The virus then migrated to Haiti, and then from the Caribbean to the U.S. during a boat lift in 1977. But Jonathan, there is no connection between AIDS and the H1N1 virus. For many years, the CDC and World Health Organization have tried not to classify diseases and virus on animal names or geographic locations. So things like swine flu and Spanish flu, which, by the way, did not originate from Spain, all those are not only inaccurate names now, but are gauche. And even I'm updating my own vocabulary. But to go back a bit, you are right. There is no link between H1N1 and AIDS. The link, which was later shown, existed between SV40, or the simian immunodeficiency virus that I mentioned earlier in this episode, found in the green monkey. So, the vague timeline goes like this. A mutated batch of SV40 is introduced into the population of Cuba in the very early 70s. This would be ground zero for the emergence of AIDS. The virus then migrates to Haiti in the mid-70s, where it explodes. During relief efforts in the Caribbean by the U.S. military, the virus comes into the States. Due to travel and interpersonal contact, the virus is thus transmitted globally. Every step in that timeline is easy to believe, except for the first one involving Cuba. Cuba, as far as can be surmised, didn't exactly have large laboratories filled with monkeys to create tissue mutations, nor were there batches of vaccines designated just for Cuba that were coming in through regular channels that would have been contaminated. Because that's the sort of thing that makes the news, especially so close to our coast. Now, we are unable to go off of capital F facts, because over the course of two episodes on this topic, there have been very few facts presented. But we can continue the game of yes and that we've been playing up to this point, which makes for a far crazier and more interesting story. We know, for instance, that Soviet Russia was working on biological agents in the second half of the 20th century, and they probably had weirdly designed particle accelerators, because almost all advanced Soviet technology from the time was weirdly designed. Just look at their aircraft for further indications. Now, whether the Soviets used monkeys in their experiments or political prisoners is up for debate, but that's also the sort of thing we will never know for certain. So, I guess that's a blank check you conspiracy writers can run with to create your next best-selling self-published books. Just don't forget to thank me. What we do know, at least within the realm of this story, is that in the early 1960s, there was supposedly an underground lab developing mutations from SV40 here in New Orleans. In 1964, the Primate Center opened in New Orleans. And we know that David Ferry didn't just drop his interest in cancer research like a bunch of unnamed men dropping the smoldering body of Dr. Mary Sherman in the middle of the night. In fact, it's very possible, if not probable, that David Ferry continued his work. Hell, he may even have had access to the particle accelerator. Or maybe he just worked with the existing examples that were sent to his little lab with all of the mice. If it's the former, that's a huge claim that requires further research. If it's the latter, it would point to an earlier starting point for AIDS than what's on our timeline. Either way, both options point to some very sinister implications about a global health crisis. David Ferry certainly had access to the necessary components to create SV40 mutations. He definitely had the motive to introduce such mutations into Cuba, and he would have had the opportunity, through other people he knew, to get the virus to the designated location. Well, through the people he knew minus Oswald. Now, I want to head something off at the pass. There are a number of conspiracy theorists out there who are more than happy to tell you how AIDS was definitely engineered by the U.S. government. Such luminaries as Bill Cosby have long insisted that the United States developed AIDS as a way to wipe out people of color. If AIDS was developed in a laboratory in the 1960s, or at the latest, the early 70s, then it was by accident. Genetic science back then was still operating under the rule of, let's see what happens. Things have certainly become more refined and controlled since then. But in the 1960s and 70s, using a particle accelerator to create mutations was somewhat unpredictable. Think of it like baby's first modular synth. You have a lot of knobs and maybe a handful of patch cables, but unless you're taking extensive notes, you don't know what sound you're going to get by adjusting things, nor will you be able to replicate your results, again, without extensive notes. Ed Haslam uses the quote that the process was like shooting a gun into a computer. No one went in with a desired outcome, plugged in a few numbers, turned on a particle accelerator and said, "We've got AIDS, fellow scientists. Let's start a race war." Besides, AIDS doesn't operate that way, as has been proven time and time again. Viruses don't give a damn about your skin color, sexuality, or tax bracket. It is possible, however, that David Ferry, or the dream team of Ochsner, Sherman, and Oswald, discovered something very harmful, and that was the candidate virus they wanted to use on Castro. It just ended up being a big oopsie, the kind that backfired on the United States, the whole world, and allowed Castro to live a long life in the process. Which, given the details of the story up to this point, along with how the Warren Commission was handled, would have been par for the course. Ed Haslam's book, Dr. Mary's Monkey, was last updated in 2014, in the before times. before the novel coronavirus made its grand entrance and upended our world, disrupted the comfort levels we'd allowed ourselves to achieve, and rewrote how we interact with one another. Thankfully, or unthankfully, the novel coronavirus is wholly unrelated to SV40. COVID-19 is a variation of severe acute respiratory syndrome, otherwise known as SARS. While the disease is zoonotic in nature, meaning it's found in animals and then passed to humans, no monkeys are involved. There was a big to-do over bats when this whole thing broke. And while bats can carry SARS, civet rats can be carriers as well. Some of the most expensive coffee in the world involves civet rats who ingest the beans, and the fermentation process of digestion modifies the proteins in the coffee beans, giving them an exquisite flavor when the civets shit them out. I'm not an authority on this. Stimulants like caffeine do not agree with me. If I have coffee, it's very Irish. Most times, I skip the coffee part of the beverage entirely and go straight for the Irish. You know, for health reasons. But we can take away the cold comfort that the novel coronavirus, like many viruses that exist and evolve in this world, were not created in some underground lab. But was AIDS engineered in a lab? Was the increase in various cancers in the second half of the 20th century the result of an underground experiment in New Orleans and similar labs throughout the world? Well, if you ask Ed Haslam, you're not going to get an answer. It happens to be his specialty. In fact, his book does a great job of drawing lines, but he never quite connects the dots. Dr. Mary Sherman was indeed a director of bone pathology at the Ochsner Clinic and a professor at Tulane, and she was definitely found dead in her apartment on July 21, 1964. Judith Vary Baker is almost certainly an author who alleges that she had an affair with Lee Harvey Oswald and encountered practically everyone surrounding the JFK assassination. She also claims to live in fear of her life from people who want to keep her from telling her side of the story, which she is not hesitant to do through her books or the upcoming musical based on her experiences in New Orleans. Dr. Alton Ochsner and his son have stated that they have no records of Judith Vary Baker working for them, or the clinic, as a technician, or any other role. So unless she was being bankrolled by someone else, we really have no proof of anything. There is evidence that David Ferry rented an apartment on Louisiana Avenue Parkway in New Orleans, and he did indeed write at least one treatise on cancer, and kept mice. It seemed to be a major preoccupation of his. The U.S. Public Health Service Hospital was in use during 1964, and there were numerous skilled and brilliant professionals dedicated to finding a cure for cancer. But a good reason for the increase in cases with cancer can be attributed to things like smoking, the fact that leaded gas was a thing, and the fumes clouded our skies for decades. We thought we were immune to the horrible food we put in our bodies. And chemistry kits that were sold to the me generation kids came packed with radioactive elements. Our population grew after World War II, and the kids from the baby boom grew up without the focus on health and well-being that we have today, so they developed very serious health problems. In the end, the conspiracy surrounding the death of Dr. Mary Sherman is much like that abandoned building at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital that supposedly housed a linear particle accelerator. For something this wild to make any sense at all, you have to look for what is no longer there. And that's the story. That's it. We are done with Dr. Mary's monkey. Remember, next week is another casual episode, but the week after that, I'm going to be taking you all on a trip out west for a tale of extraterrestrial terror. Also, for those of you listening this week, I want to remind you that this Friday is the first Friday of October, which means Bandcamp is giving 100% of their sales revenue to artists. So go out there and pick up your favorite music, or even better, explore new music on Bandcamp on Friday and help out artists who really don't have live venues to play gigs anymore. You don't know where to look? Let's start off with The Tomb of Nick Cage and Beth Patterson. Move on to Stone Groove Records. I know you'll find something, and you'll be helping out amazing artists and friends of this show in the process. I'll put links in the show notes. And keep those Mothballoween contest entries coming in. I'm really excited to put together a show that features original stories, personal experiences from listeners, and some great recorded tracks. And hey, you could win some cool stuff for entering. I've set the cutoff date for October 20th, so bring out your best creepy and send it to mothball@crescentcitymedia.com. Until next time, sleep tight.